Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Many people that have looked at this in the past, academics have said, well, obviously they went for fewer cities because they had less capability. What exactly would the unilateral threat have to present to the Soviet Union? And it was felt that rendering uninhabitable the two biggest cities and maybe one or two more would be perfectly adequate to present a level of damage that would be completely unacceptable to the Soviet Union.
Welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Tony Redding. Dr. Redding is a military historian and author with a particular interest in RAF Bomber Command. He joins us today to talk through the operational capability and the credibility of Britain's airborne nuclear deterrent during the peak years of the Cold War. Tony, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. I know you're really busy at the moment, out and about publishing the book. But I mentioned Bomber Command there. You're a published author. Where's aviation featured in your life? How did aviation come into things?
Well, I'd always intended to write a book on Bomber Command in World War II. And it turned out that a chap in the local horticultural society of our village was a rear gunner. And we had a chat over a cup of tea. And I said to him really quite casually, maybe we could collaborate at some point and I'll write a book about your two operational tours. And he promptly then moved away from the village. I don't think that was connected with my invitation. He wanted to be near his daughter, so he moved from East Kent to Stoke-on-Trent. I didn't hear anything from him for 6 months, and then he called and he said, OK, I'm ready.
Right, OK.
I was really quite surprised at what, in fact, he'd done. He completed 64 operational sorties across his two tours, and he'd written out his recollections of every single operational sortie.
Wow.
I was absolutely amazed, and he's a very modest man, a very quiet man, and he simply said, well, I wanted to be sure that I had something to say, and I was absolutely amazed at his recall. I started to interview him. I got myself a copy of the Bomber Command War Diaries, which provides a spine, a structure, so that you can look at his two tours in their context and also look at the individual raids. Did a lot more research, interviewed family and chaps who were still alive at that time who flew with him. Gradually, over a period of 3 years, built up an incredibly detailed book on the two squadrons that he served in. 467 Squadron was an Australian squadron.
Okay.
And then he went on after 30 trips there and a DFC. He moved on to a Pathfinder Squadron 518, based at Little Staunton, and he did over 30 trips with that squadron in 1944, a year later. I sat down with a mathematician, and we figured out that he had around about a 3% chance of survival.
Wow.
And,
wow.
When the engine stopped on his 64th sortie, he didn't fly again until the 1970s when he took a charter flight to Spain for a holiday.
It was his first, right, okay.
first flight. So that was the first book. And what I really wanted to do, I wanted to write a book about my father and his time in Orb Wingate's Chindit Force in the North Burmese jungle in 1944.
Yeah.
I couldn't risk disturbing him. He found it very difficult to talk about that. And an incident happened that basically told me that I could never write the book whilst he was alive. So I wrote the book on Sydney, Warrant Officer Sydney, not DFC. Remarkably, this Lancaster rear gunner is still alive, and he'll be 103, God willing, on VE Day this year.
Wow.
So absolutely amazing. And then I went on to write a book about the last area night raid by Bomber Command in World War II on a German city. That occurred 10 days after the raid on Dresden on the 23rd of February 1945. And it was actually worse than Dresden if you relate the number of people killed to the urban area. It was an attack on the South German city of Pforzheim, which is between Stuttgart and Karlsruhe. And 17,000 people, a quarter of the population, died in a firestorm. I concentrated on the air crew, survivors of the air crew who flew the raid. But I also visited Pforzheim on seven occasions and interviewed raid survivors. So I tried to tell the story from the German side as well.
So that was
World War II, but
yeah.
There was unfinished business. My father passed away, and I wrote the book about the Chindits called War in the Wilderness.
Yeah.
And then I decided that I'd write a book about the Cold War. And there were two reasons for that. Firstly, at the age of 13, at my school in Greenwich, on a Friday, it would have been the 26th of October 1962, I remember walking down the corridor, ironically, towards a physics lesson, and I saw a prefect coming towards me, and I said to him, "But what's the latest about Cuba?" And the prefect looked at me and said, "It's war at 3 o'clock," and walked on, which quite shocked me.
Right, so, okay.
Unlike World War II, I had a direct contact with the Cold War. And the one thing that I could never understand about the V-bomber force is that there's a huge literature surrounding it. Obviously, Vulcans, Victors, Valiants, the Anglo-American nuclear relationship, building the UK bomb, obviously the raids, the Black Buck raids in the Falklands. There's a huge literature, but virtually zero. Hardly anything at all about what they would have done if they had been asked to carry out their primary mission, which was a nuclear attack on Russia. So there was unfinished business there, so I decided to investigate it.
Okay. So before we look at the aircraft and the capabilities and the weapons, can we just set some concepts? Context. You mentioned Cuba there. Obviously, some of our listeners, unlike probably you and me, Tony, didn't live through some of the Cold War challenges. What was the requirement to bring in airborne nuclear capability?
The day after the atomic weapon was dropped on Nagasaki, there was a committee meeting, a cabinet meeting, and a discussion about what exactly should happen and should Britain build a nuclear weapon. There was a snag to that in that although we cooperated with the Americans during the war in the Manhattan Project and contributed quite significantly to it, an act in Congress forbade any sharing of nuclear information with third powers, including Britain. So if we were going to build a nuclear weapon, it would have been on our own. And the decision was taken that there had to be a nuclear weapon with a Union Jack on it. And the question was, what means would be used to deliver it? Well, at that time, obviously the V2 has shown the way to the future, but in the very early 1950s, ballistic missiles were looked upon as with some suspicion. They were unproven technology, and the Western powers have calculated that by 1957, the Russians would have recovered from the ravages of World War II to a sufficient extent to start World War III. So the requirement was to have an operating deterrent, active and capable and credible by the turn of the mid-1950s. And in fact, the Valiant was operational with a nuclear weapon in 1957. And that's the reason why we ended up with a small force of subsonic nuclear bombers, whereas the superpowers, of course, had their bombers, but they also had ballistic missiles.
Right. And Tony, why did we end up with three different aircraft types delivering, in effect, the same sortie of mission?
Well, I think there was always a feeling that at some point a choice would be made between the three types. And there was a move at one point that the Valiant should be built and the others should be abandoned. And then it was an opposition party, if I can call it that, that argued in favour of the Vulcan and Victor because they were more advanced aircraft, and the Valiant was seen as an interim aircraft. It's interesting because it mirrors, of course, the situation in the Second World War, where we had the Lancaster, which was Bomber Harris's shining sword, as he called it, a very superior type of heavy bomber at that time. And there was also the other two types, the Stirling and the Halifax. So we had three bombers then. In fact, there were four V bombers. There was an aircraft called the Sperrin, which was perhaps even more interim than the Valiant. That was abandoned. I think it was used as an engine. The prototypes were used as engine test beds, but the Valiant went into production, and it actually saw combat in 1956 during the Suez Crisis and the bombing of Egyptian airfields and other targets. But obviously, in the conventional sense, they were wonderful aircraft. The Victor, for example. Looks like something out of Dan Dare,
Yeah, it's
Dan
amazing,
Dare
isn't it?
Means anything to you. I mean, it looks like a spaceship.
Yeah,
I mean,
Doctor Who.
To see it bobbing up in takeoff from an airfield with a hump in it is a sight to behold. I mean, it truly does look like almost like a sort of starship. It's so different. And in fact, in the last couple of years of its career as a tanker in the Royal Air Force, one of them landed at an American Air Force base, and a US Air Force officer came up to the captain of the Victor, and he said, "Geez, is that your new stealth bomber?"
Well ahead of its time. Yeah,
it had been around for 40 years, and I mean, the Vulcan was a complete showstopper. I mean, when it went off for its test flight, the test pilot, who was wearing a suit at the time, his collar and tie, he took off and rolled the machine.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable.
And Tony, when these three aircraft types were under development and coming into service, were they developed with the ambition they would be operating a nuclear deterrent and carrying nuclear activities, or were they purely and simply designed for normal service, for normal bombing, traditional type service?
All three types had a conventional capability. For example, the Vulcan carried 21 1,000-pound conventional bombs, and of course the Victor, because there was great rivalry between the companies Avro and Hanley Page, I think a fall load was 35 1,000-pound bombs, but in many ways it was incidental. The primary role, and the role that was in the public and the political mind, was to provide a credible nuclear deterrent to carry what were called at that time special weapons.
Yeah, okay.
It's very important when you think about Britain's nuclear deterrent and you think of the small numbers of aircraft involved, and more particularly the very small numbers that will survive a strike on their airfields. You have to remember that one Vulcan releasing a weapon could have the destructive potential of 75,000 or even 150,000 wartime Lancasters in one weapon. Blue Steel Standoff bomb or Yellow Sun 2 freefall bomb had an explosive equivalent of 1.1 million tons.
Wow.
That's the key point. If you can't kill them all, then you're still under threat. And that's the key thing to think about. Yeah. If you're Russian.
Well, let me come back to the capabilities of the nuclear weapons, because I'd like to understand that a little bit more. And that's really part and parcel of, I think, why you came about writing the book, because there was there was lots written about the V-bomber force in, as you say, in a conventional role, but very little in the nuclear role. How were they stacking up against the Soviet defences? What were these aircraft set up against in terms of the attack profiles from the Soviets?
Well, there are two things to think about. The first thing is, can they get off the ground if there's a missile strike on their airfields? And the Joint Intelligence Committee decided that, in fact, probably four nuclear weapons would have been targeted on each of the airfields. That's the main bases and dispersals. So the first issue is, can they get away? Or can some of them get away? Can enough of them get away to present a credible threat? And the second issue is, however many actually get away from the airfields and begin their wartime sorties by crossing the North Sea, how many would get through the defences? I mean, the Soviet order of battle was horrific. Several thousand fighters, gun systems, including a particularly lethal four-barreled gun system known as Shilka, which theoretically at least could fire 1,000 rounds per barrel. So that's 4,000 shells a minute.
Wow.
I mean, it would have fired far less in number.
Yeah.
But certain Israeli pilots from the 1973 war onwards came to understand that if you get close to that gun system, it's always lethal. So there was the gun system, there were high-level surface-to-air missile SAM systems, and there were low-level systems, there were the fighters. But the great thing to remember about the Soviet Union is its huge geographical spread. And, of course, any one aircraft will only face a very small slice of those defences.
Yeah.
So you have to look at it from that perspective. But nevertheless, the odds were daunting. The Russians actually spent more on air defense than they did on nuclear weapons for a large period in the 50s onwards. And it was terrific. They built up a coastal defense network of defenses, and that included patrolling long-range fighters, patrolling offshore. They had a very dense coastal defense network of surface-to-air missiles. They had area long-range, long-endurance missile-armed fighters providing an area defense. And on the most important targets, they had two or three concentric rings of SAM defenses around the big cities. So there are a lot of defenses to penetrate. But it was, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you talked about concentric rings around key targets. In your research, did the targets that the Allied forces were, or the NATO forces were looking to penetrate, the same targets that the Soviets were looking to defend?
Well, I think you have to sort of. It's a question in many parts, really. I think in the early life of the V force, it was calculated that the V bombers had the capability to destroy 40 Russian cities, and they would render 38 million people. I think the word used was ineffective. That was judged at one point to be over the top, unnecessarily large scale, and it was decided to trim down expectations to 20 large cities, and then it was trimmed down to 5, and we'll talk about what happened after that at some point. But it was Moscow, Leningrad, and maybe two or three other centres. That was the focus of attention. The idea was to render enough destruction on the Russians unilaterally to undermine the balance between the superpowers. So, in other words, if you could take out, for example, the first and second cities of the Soviet Union, Moscow and Leningrad, that would obviously place it at a very severe disadvantage to America. So all the crews, they had two target sets. They had Plan A. Plan A was the NATO war fighting plan. So that would be for general war, and all the targets were military. But of course, the targets, for the most part, were in the major urban centres, military headquarters and
right.
So on.
Yeah.
So that was Plan A. And Plan B was what we could do under the national plan, i.e. unilaterally, not part of general war. What was the nuclear threat, the credible nuclear threat posed by the British V-bomber force? And that was Plan B. And the focus there was not on military targets, it was on destroying the big cities. So it was deterrence through the threat of punishment, right, rather than denying what was known as counter force. So all crews trained for the two target sets. But I think if you were a citizen of Leningrad, St. Petersburg, as it is now, it wouldn't have made much difference whether an attacking V-bomber was attacking under Plan A or Plan B. I don't think you would have noticed the difference, if indeed you had a chance to notice anything.
yeah. Good point. I'd picked up counterforce strategy in the book. I thought it was an interesting concept. Can you just expand a little bit on that for us?
Yeah, things changed over a period of time. The target sets changed. The expectation or the definition, perhaps, is a better word of what a credible deterrent from the British standpoint would amount to change over time. It was an evolution. But there was a time, perhaps in the early part of V-Force life, where it was felt that the main priority in a retaliatory strike against the Soviet Union, our main priority would be to take out the long-range bomber force so far as one could, that directly threatened Britain and also some of the intermediate range ballistic missile sites, and basically reduce the scale of the nuclear threat to Britain. It was then felt that because obviously the operational capabilities of the V-Force declined as the Soviet defences improved, and also it declined because we were unable to provide long-range standoff weapons for the V-Force for reasons perhaps I'll get into later. The expectations were scaled down, and the focus was very much on destroying the really big cities. It became known as the Moscow Criterion, and essentially all that meant was that it didn't matter what the Soviets did to protect their capital city, the British would find a way of circumventing that layer of protection and destroy Moscow. And that still applied into the Polaris era, where the Chevalier came along, and that increased the penetration aids with the specific purpose of being able to get through the defences and destroy Moscow. So it was, many people that have looked at this in the past, academics have said, well, obviously they went for fewer cities because they had less capability. But it was actually far more sophisticated than that. They were thinking in terms of what exactly would the British threat, the unilateral threat, have to present to the Soviet Union. And it was felt that rendering uninhabitable the two biggest cities, and maybe one or two more, would be perfectly adequate to present a level of damage that would be completely unacceptable to the Soviet Union. Yeah. In fact, the Joint Intelligence Committee at one point made a draft report where they suggested that even one city, and that obviously that would have been Moscow, would be enough to achieve that credible level of threat, a threat strong enough to deter.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
We talked about NATO, mentioned NATO a while back. Was there a coordination amongst the NATO forces, particularly obviously the USA, to target particular, for a party to target a particular area, or was there overlap, or did we identify targets separately? How did that coordination work?
Well, there was always a strong level of coordination between the US Air Force and the RAF, which dated back to the days of World War II and the round-the-clock bombing campaign against Germany. So there was always that spirit of cooperation. And in the late 1950s, when this cooperation was formalised, it was found that the RAF and the US Air Force, basically, they had common target sets. So the single integrated operations plan called SIOP was developed and introduced. And SIOP basically was NATO's plan for general war. And it allocated specific targets to specific air forces. And it gave the RAF a particular target set. And they had the responsibility for delivering attacks on those targets, and that set changed over time. It wasn't static. I mean, in the beginning, it featured heavily a large number of cities.
Yeah.
Featured fewer cities, but majored more heavily on bomber airfields and ballistic missile sites, for example, and then it changed yet again. So it was an evolving target pattern. But the main imperative throughout, I believe, for the British government would have been the unilateral capability. Now, a lot of people say, well, it's ridiculous to talk about the national plan, because Britain would certainly never wage nuclear war on its own. That would only happen in relation to allies. Well, I think almost certainly that is true, but they're missing the point. The point about the British deterrent was that it represented a second set of nuclear decision-making, a second centre of decision-making beyond Washington and the Pentagon. An independent second centre to worry about, which complicated things. And it was not so much what the V force would do. It was really all about what it could do. It was its contribution to deterrence of war rather than war fighting. I mean, to put it bluntly, in a general war, a few hydrogen bombs on target from the V-Force isn't going to make any difference. It's the end of the world anyway.
Yeah.
but from a unilateral point of view, theoretically, the threat, and a credible threat, is there to take out the first and second city of the Soviet Union. And I mean, that will be damage that will be completely unacceptable to the Soviets, and therefore it is a deterrent to an aggressor nation. And it's my belief that it worked, even though the numbers of surviving weapon systems would have been very small.
Yeah. And Tony, tell us about the capabilities of some of these nuclear bombs. I mean, I'm trying to get, obviously, having seen some of the pictures and read the book, can you explain the size of them? Because I think it's quite interesting to try and get your head around what does a nuclear weapon look like. Obviously, these aircraft are big, heavy bombers, but they're not that big. And you look at a Polaris missile, they're massive things. Can you give us some context for the physical size and the capabilities of some of these weapons?
Well, the first British weapon was called Blue Danube. The British were always very keen on colours in naming their weapons. And Blue Danube was a monster. It was over 5 feet in diameter in the maximum area. It housed a spherical physics package, and it had a nuclear yield of approximately 15 kilotons, that's 15,000 tons, which is broadly equivalent to the weapons that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was huge. It was 30 feet long, a bit longer than that, I think. It just about fitted into the bomb bay of the V bombers. You had to drop it from altitude, and it was huge. it was always the intention eventually to equip all the V-bombers with standoff bombs. And the idea was that if you could launch a standoff bomb from 1,000 miles or 1,200 miles range, you wouldn't have to enter the defences. You could basically release the weapon in undefended airspace and then return. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. The V-Force, or part of it, five squadrons of it, of the V-Force, were eventually armed with something called Blue Steel 1, and that was essentially a rocket bomb. And you could fire it at altitude 150 nautical miles from the target, and a couple of minutes later, it would detonate and destroy the target. But the aircraft itself, although it may well have had to enter defended airspace, it wouldn't have to enter the point defences around the target. Unfortunately, when Gary Powers' U-2 was shot down on May the 1st, 1960, over Russia during a photo reconnaissance mission, he was shot down at 70,000 feet, which was much higher than the operating ceiling of the V-bombers, and it was felt that high-altitude nuclear strike was really a thing of the past. And the British acted really quickly. They converted Blue Steel for low-level launch, and they turned a high-altitude nuclear strike force into a low-altitude nuclear strike force. So they went from 50,000 feet plus to 500 feet virtually in the space of a year.
Wow.
They converted the Blue Steel to be able to launch from 250, 300 feet. Unfortunately, that reduced its range, which was already, frankly, inadequate, to between 30 and 50 miles from the target, which put it dangerously close, the delivery aircraft, dangerously close to the outer ring of defences on a big city like Moscow and Leningrad. What instead of having a really long-range standoff weapon, the V-Force ended up with Blue Steel 1 at low level with a range of about 30 to 50 miles and free-fall bombs, which meant that you had to overfly the target or get very, very close to the target.
Yeah.
That position never improved. It was going to improve with Skybolt, an air-launched ballistic missile. And some of the V-bombers were actually fitted with hardpoints to take these weapons. But Skybolt was cancelled in late 1962. At a meeting between President Kennedy and Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, and the British were shocked and horrified, or at least they presented themselves as shocked and horrified. I secretly think that Macmillan was a very clever guy, and the British had long recognised that a submarine-launched ballistic missile would be a far more effective deterrent than a small force of subsonic bombers. But they couldn't get Polaris without strings. The Americans were prepared to offer it, but on a European basis rather than for Britain alone. And, of course, Britain wanted an independent nuclear deterrent, or as independent as it could be. And they were prepared to take Skybolt, but I think all along what they really wanted was Polaris. And because Macmillan claimed that the cancellation of Skybolt put the special relationship under threat, he was placated by the offer of Polaris without strings, which was the best possible deal that we could have ever had. It's the perfect small nation deterrent, because the launch platform is very secure compared to a force of V-bombers on the ground. And the actual weapons have a far better chance of reaching their targets than a surviving V-bomber. So he did very well. He came home. He came home with the goods.
Let's talk about surviving then. Let's talk about the crews. How did operating a nuclear deterrent change the approach to flying operations? You mentioned high level to low level flying. How did the crews respond to that?
They loved it. The V-Force was presented as an elite force. But a lot of people actually in the V-Force were locked in there because it was very expensive to train to that standard. And the tours were long tours, and everybody was expected to do at least two tours. And, for example, it could mean that you'd spend the next 5 years on an airfield in eastern England rather than flying Canberras and going all over the world and enjoying life in some of the sunnier places in the world. So it wasn't first prize for young aircrew in particular. So instead of flying around at high altitude, not really doing a lot, dropping radar bombs on radar targets, to fly aggressively at low level, really spice the whole thing up for a lot of aircrew.
Yeah.
And it soon came to the point where 500 feet was actually seen as high, too high, dangerously
right,
high.
Okay.
And some guys, when they went to train over the Arctic snowfields at Goose Bay in Labrador, they were flying down to 200 feet or even lower. And one veteran told me that his captain would even go down to 50 feet over a calm sea. And the ground crew would complain that when he came back, the whole aircraft was covered in salt.
Wow.
These guys, it was fantastic, really, because what it boiled down to was this. As obsolescence began to creep up on the V-bomber force and its weapons, the RAF commanders came to rely more and more on the skill and expertise and the willingness of the crews to adopt extreme combat tactics. And they really were extreme. For example, an advanced freefall weapon that came into service in mainly in early 1967 was called the WE-177. It was unusual because it didn't have a name, it only had a number, but it was probably the most sophisticated free-fall nuclear weapon ever built. And it stayed in service for 30 years with the, or nearly 30 years with the Royal Air Force. And in the end, it was carried by Tornadoes. And this thing had a destructive power equivalent to 450,000 tons of high explosive.
Blimey.
It was a laid-down weapon. And you could drop it from as low as 60 feet.
Wow.
And it was retarded by a special parachute system.
Yeah.
And that would break it for an impact speed of around 112 miles an hour. And the idea was to put it on the ground, and it had a detonation time of around 30 seconds. And the reason for that was they wanted to make sure that it couldn't be disabled on the ground. There wouldn't be any time to disable it.
Right.
And if you add on the release to landing of the weapon, the detonation time and the speed of shockwave catching up with the aircraft. The aircraft had about 60 seconds to reach escape speed, escape distance, which was around 6 miles. I did ask the question, dropping WE-177 on what remained of Moscow, for example, was that a survivable case? And the feeling is yes, but I think it would have got rather hot.
Yeah. And a lot's been talked about that sort of one flight operation, you know, because the nuclear deterrent worked both ways. And potentially there was only the flight out and possibly nowhere to come back to. One of the things I was quite intrigued about is how the RAF culture dealt with that. What did you find in your research that sort of manifests that culture?
Well, I think the RAF were economical with the truth. They briefed crews on what they needed to know to get to the target and drop the weapon, and to some degree how to come back, well, whatever that actually meant. What they didn't do is give them the big picture, and they certainly didn't tell them that they had a very small chance of escaping a war scramble, and maybe only a 50% chance that the small group of survivors would successfully release their weapons. Basically, if you were under the best conditions, it was called Alert Condition 1, where 30% of the bombers, that's about 24 aircraft, it probably would have increased to about 30 of the 80 aircraft generated, would be dispersed to airfields in the far north and the far west. Ballykelly in Northern Ireland right. would have been a really good place to go, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
They would be cockpit manned round the clock, and you'd have to allocate two crews to each aircraft to achieve that, obviously. And the plan was to give them priority targets. They were called flight alert targets. And almost certainly that would have been Moscow and Leningrad. And everybody knew how to attack those targets because they were the quick reaction alert targets. That was the minimum response, one aircraft in eight, one aircraft in every squadron was kept armed and fueled and ready to go at 15 minutes readiness, but under alert condition one, they would be kept cockpit manned. So that was 5 minutes. You got the doors closed, everybody's inside, and you could do all your checks up to readiness state 2 minutes, which was engine start. And if you wanted to survive a war scramble, you had to be really in one of those 30 aircraft in the far north and or west, which would give you up to a minute and a bit of extra time geographically if the 4 minute warning was declared. But you'd need to be first in the queue, and you need to hope that the first missile aimed at your airfield would be slightly late and hopefully slightly off course. I mean, in a nutshell, I doubt whether more than 10% of the 80 bombers would have got off.
And we've talked a lot about Northern Europe, Tony. We talked about Moscow. We talked about Leningrad being primary strike areas and obviously striking from UK bases. I was quite interested to hear about how the southern areas of the Soviet Union region would be attacked. Where would that be done from?
Well, firstly, it's quite interesting that the operational life of the V-Force was only halfway through when in 1969 the strategic frontline baton was passed to the Polaris submarines. They continued in operation, of course, until early 1982 and the Black Buck Falklands raids.
Yeah.
But in 1969, when the Polaris took over the nuclear front line, the V-bombers continued in a supplementary role, and two squadrons, 9th Squadron and 35th Squadron, were sent to Akrotiri, Cyprus. And from there, they targeted the a whole range of southern targets in Russia. And they were armed with WE-177B strategic weapons. And they were a very serious, fresh threat to the Soviet Union. And obviously, that meant a large economic expenditure on fresh defences on that southern flank.
And then just before we start to wrap up, Tony, let's look back through the lens of history, because we can do that now with the Cold War, although it feels like we've got Cold War II on the agenda today. But did the valiant Victor Vulcan, that whole V-Force, deliver against the nuclear frontline requirements it was set out to be to do, do you think?
I think it's... It was the biggest defence bargain in British military history. And unfortunately, as a bargain, it was milked mercilessly by the government with its peace dividend.
Yeah.
And you got huge cuts in conventional forces sheltering under a nuclear umbrella. Unfortunately, when the nuclear umbrella declined and... the cuts, the peace dividend cuts continued, then we got a resurgence of an aggressive Russia, and we still carried on with taking out the peace dividend, and we find ourselves in an embarrassment of difficulties at the moment on the defence front, and that's the reason why. We took the money, we spent it on for very good purposes, but for me, and I think a lot of people will feel the same way, the prime responsibility of any government in the UK is to protect its citizens from a defence point of view, and that should be the starting point.
Fascinating stuff, really, really fascinating. Looked back on those aircraft in a very different light. Tony, where can we find you and the book online?
Okay, well, the book is published by Grub Street, and they can be found on their website, grubstreet.co.uk. Of course, it's available on Amazon. Sources such as the Aviation Bookshop and my website, tonyredding, one word, .co.uk.
Okay, Tony, that's it. Thank you. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music and Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian for all of their support. We'd also like to thank Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. You can find me and Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Ellie and Gareth on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram free feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's a very goodbye from Tony.
Thank you.
And it's a goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
from across the globe, from the centre of aerospace. And now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.